back. We didn't want this part to go on the publication. If you leave from today and you're overwhelmed, just keep in mind the basic passage that you want to hold on to is Habakkuk 1:5, where it says, "Look among the nations, observe, be astonished, wonder. If I'm doing something in your day, you wouldn't believe, even if you're told." God is moving in a very powerful way, but it happens to be running under the surface of what's going on that's popping up in the news. But seeing God's hand underneath it, sometimes it gets obscured. The second passage is in John 4, where Jesus says, "The harvest is plentiful, but the laborers are few. Beseech the Lord of the harvest to send..." The fields are white for harvest. The fields are white for harvest. I get them mixed up a little bit here. But the fields are white for harvest, and God is doing some things to indicate, to basically prepare us for a significant number of Muslims coming to faith as we've never seen before. So part of my job with Pioneers is to help prepare our organization for a major infusion of Muslims coming to faith as we've never seen before. So just to give you a little bit of background of who I am and where I'm coming from, I'm going to be giving you some information. We'll be talking about Islam and Islamic movements and what's going on in the history of Islam, so you can understand the background of what's going on in Islam and Islamic world. Then I have kind of two, we'll have a little break, and then I'll have another little presentation as to taking part A and part B together and bringing us up to what we're doing right now and why we're doing it. Then I want to take as many questions I can take from you guys. I love that part more than I do presenting, is taking your questions spontaneously and giving you a little bit of background as why this is happening and why that's happening. What about Sunni? What about Shia? What about different things? So I love the question and answer part. So as they say on Car Talk, stump the chump kind of thing. So if you feel like you want to throw a wild one at me, I probably have looked at most of them. My talk today is going to be on Islam, radicalism, and the Great Commission. And my goal is to help us get our head around what's going on in the Islamic world. One of the things is, how can you understand 1.2 billion Muslims in the world? One of the ways that you know if someone really understands what they're talking about when you talk about Islam is that when they say, "Islam is like this," and they begin to describe some type of thing about Islam, that's the first indicator that they don't know what they're talking about, because Islam is too big to say Islam is this. It's broad, it's based, it's complex, it's everything. Muslims, on the other hand, which is those people underneath the religion, are the ones that are most important to try to understand. What is it to how you can understand Muslims within Islam? One way to think of it is, first of all, is to think about their spirituality. Muslims are made up into, you can understand them in three thirds. The first third is basically what's called your secularist. They are just essentially like most of America, who they are Christian in some sense, but they never go to church. They really are not actively involved in their religion. They really don't understand a whole lot. They probably have never even read a Quran. They may not even have a Quran. And they know as little about the religion as you know. So as a result, if you want to share the gospel with them, you basically just do like you talk about normal people. Forget trying to understand or be sensitive. Just go for it. Just share whatever you want to share. Share the scriptures. Share whatever. Pray for them and tell them that you pray for them. But it's really, they're not much different than you and me. The second group is what's called the moderates. And those people have some understanding of Islam and are very much involved in their what they call high identity but low practice. They understand Islam and they do the religious practices, but they don't know a whole lot either. So if you're into wanting to be sensitive, there's different books you can read about understanding about how Muslim practices are. There's a couple I mentioned right here, and there's several others. I don't want to spend time talking about which books are good to read, but essentially reading any kind of book which helps you understand a little bit about the Islamic religion. The third group is what's called the fundamentalists, and those are the people that I have met with and dealt with on an ongoing basis. These people understand the religion, and if you want to understand more about fundamentalists, Keith Swartley has written a good book called Encountering the World of Islam. Interesting thing is about in the fundamentalist group, about 24% of them are experiencing dreams and visions about Jesus calling them to himself. So oftentimes I'll engage a conversation with them. I'll just say, "Hey, look, I know you guys have dreams and visions often. Tell me what your dream or vision is." And they will, all of a sudden, they'll, first of all, can't believe that I even know that they have these things. And then they'll say, Well, yeah, and they'll start telling me these things that are just flat out cool as God is working in their life. It's almost like Samuel, when Eli, when Samuel was having this vision of God coming to him, and he'd run to Eli and he'd say, "Yes, Eli." And then after a couple of these types of things, Eli says to Samuel, "Okay, when the next time you have a vision, say, 'Here am I, Lord, speak to me.'" Well, there's a significant number of Muslims who are having dreams and visions, but they don't have Elis who are telling them how they can connect with the God who's speaking to them through these dreams and visions. So I just basically act as an Eli. What's your dream and vision? What's it about? And I end up helping them, guide them through, saying, "Here's what I think God is telling you," and then leading them into the scriptures. There's another group that is called your radical groups. It makes up about 12% of the Islamic world. And then there's Islamists, which are the jihadis on the upper end. There's about 4%. By and large, you should try to avoid them. I've dealt with a couple of them. I actually met Abu Bakr Basir, who is the guy who did the Bali 1, Bali 2 bombings. He was the brains behind those types of things. He's in charge of a group called Jamaat Islamia, and they are somehow tied in with Al-Qaeda. So it's good for you, and you probably won't run across them anyway, and you wouldn't even recognize them if you did run across them. I run across them and do recognize them because I know how they operate. But they are ones that you should avoid and just say, move on. But you will typically be involved in both the secularist and the moderate. Those are the Muslims who are coming to town. I just stopped at a little diner on the way in here, and I met a guy there who was Turkish, and he's probably a Turkish secularist. And I thought about starting up a conversation with him, but I had to get my down here. But those are the ones you'll run across most often. The big question that many people ask is, what is it that the Islamists want? What are they mad about? Why are they wanting to blow stuff up and continue to be in the problems? I have had the privilege, as I mentioned to you before, of meeting and working with several people. One of the guys you see in the upper left-hand corner, his name is Ismail Yusanto. He is the head of Hizb ut-Tahrir in Indonesia, and he invited me to participate in the Caliphate Conference in Jakarta, Indonesia. The Caliphate Conference is one place where 90,000 radicals, and some of them were jihadists, were in one big stadium, and one little white guy, and I was up there with the little white guy, and it was a very interesting time to be involved in this conference. I also had a chance to work a lot with Muslim Brotherhood. I've co-written an article with a guy from Muslim Brotherhood. His name is Yang Mahmoudi. And so he and I discuss and talk about things all the time, and I did a major research project with Yang Mahmoudi. So I'm starting to understand Muslim Brotherhood and also Hizb ut-Tahrir and what their worldviews are, what is it that they want and their goals. To understand where Islam is today, you really have to understand where they come from and what the history of Islam is. One of the ways to do that is just to, let me just kind of give you a real quick history, because I don't want you to get lost in all these names and come out of this thing totally confused, the drinking out of the water hose problem. In Muhammad died in about 632, and after he had inspired and gave the Quran, and then the problem he didn't really lay out was succession of leadership. So here he is, his body's laying on a slab, and they're getting ready to bury him, and his group of band of followers he had been following him were discussing who's going to be the next leader. There became two parts of the succession of leadership. One was what eventually became the Sunnis, and the next group was called the Shias. The Sunnis basically said leadership needs to follow after people who follow the essential basics of Islam. And they said that was what Muhammad wanted, was succession of leadership based upon the Quranic, following the Islamic way. Then there's the Shia who says the succession of leadership needs to be someone who is a blood relative of Muhammad. And this argument started even as Muhammad is laying on a slab, and before they get ready to bury him, they're trying to figure out who's going to be running Islam. And it starts out that Abu Bakr was a faithful person who followed Muhammad, and he was actually halfway related to Muhammad. His wife was Muhammad's daughter, and they selected him as the first leader. But he didn't live long, about 2 years, and then he died of old age. Then the second one was a guy named Umar, who was also Sunni, and he was a pretty good leader, but he was assassinated by a Persian madman. He ruled for about 10 or 12 years. But the third one was a guy named Uthman. He was also a Sunni, but he began to shift the religious practices to become starting to almost shape it as it is today. At the very beginning, Islam was very religious and very militaristic because of everybody was militaristic at that time. But Uthman took it to a new level. He became more corrupt. He became more interested in his own power position. He took on the term caliphate, where everybody else was just servant of the Most High Allah. Then there was a group called the Qarajites who began to say Islam is moving down a path of that we don't like. And so they sent the first what we consider to be a suicide bomber, a suicide attacker, to go in and kill Uthman. Killed him while he was praying at the mosque. Now keep in mind, I'm going to lay out how these things are important. And then the next one was Ali, which was Muhammad's grandson, and he was Shia. He was selected to become the next leader, but it was a lot of warring infighting within the religious organization. A lot of people were dying, and then as a result, a Qarajite did kill him in 661. Then at that time, a military leader came and took over, and then you started the next what was called the Abbasid Empire, and Islam began to be ruled by a succession of father to son leadership in the empires within Islam. Now, the important piece to keep in mind is that this whole Sunni-Shia thing created a chaos within Islam, what they call the first fitna. And this started a long set of discussions about what does it constitute to become a leader within Islam, as a caliphate, and then how a caliphate is selected. Remember, they didn't have a way to select him. Muhammad's laying on a slab, and they're trying to figure out who's going to run this religious organization. If you understand about Catholicism, when a pope dies, they have a clear set of methods that they use for selecting the next pope. It has to do with the cardinals all getting together and voting. I don't know how they do it in a secret room, and then when he's selected, a puff of smoke comes up out of the meeting hall, and they know they've got a pope. They had a clear method by which they'd select popes. Islam doesn't have that. So selection of leadership got to be a problem. Of course, Sunni is the consensus. Shia is by blood lineage, and Qarajites is basically the goal was to try to find a sinless leader. Now then, today, Sunnis make up about 90% of Islam. They're in everywhere except for basically Iran, where the Shias are located, and a little bit of Yemen, and a little bit of Bahrain, and a little bit of Iraq. So Shias are 10%, Sunnis are about 90% of the Islamic world. The second one is the goal of who is to become a caliphate, and what to do if a caliphate or a religious leader commits sin. And the term that comes out is he's considered bitakfir. And then the Qarajite says, well, if a religious leader is sinful, he should be, according to the Quran, he should be executed, as well as anybody who's a follower of him should be executed. And that sets up a kind of procedures within Islam of a battle that goes on between Sunni, Shia, and the Qarajites no longer exist, but the ideology as the Qarajites. And that ideology is what influences Al-Qaeda. To understand a really fast history of where things go, first you got Muhammad, then you got the four caliphates I talked to you about, then it had the various regimes, the Umayyads and Abbasid, then the Ottoman Empire. Probably some of you have heard that one. It's probably a little closer in our worldview, which became the Ottoman Empire was focused in Turkey, and particularly Istanbul. And in the Ottoman Empire, after World War I, the empire was starting to go in decline, and through pressure of Europe, particularly England and France, Turkey decided to shift from the head of a caliphate system to become a secular government, and they shifted and renamed themselves. Instead of Ottoman Empire, it became Turkey. And Turkey became the first Islamic secular state, and they terminated the caliphate system. Up till then, there had been 1,000 caliphs from Muhammad all the way up to 1924. At that time, Islam fell into disrepair and also, in some sense, discouragement within their own selves. Who is going to lead Islam? Who's going to speak for Islam? And they basically became frustrated. So the issues that came up out of the results of all this was is internal leadership. And let me step back to make sure I covered everything. As the caliphate ended in 1924, there was a group that started in Egypt called Muslim Brotherhood underneath a guy named Hassan Abana. And he says the problem with Islam, with the loss of the caliphate, was the fact that they were not religious enough. So he started a movement that was internally to revival movement within Islam, Muslim Brotherhood, which is really key for that. Then there became other leaders within the outside of it, such as Said Qutb and others, who says, no, the problem is external pressures within Islam causing us not to become religious. So you had one group that felt it was an internal issue, some of them felt it was an external issue. And that continued on up to the present age. Osama bin Laden felt the issue was external, and as a result, we needed to attack America to get us to get Islam to be separated. Those unrighteous leaders like over Egypt or Saudi Arabia had to be cut away from the United States. So he authorized a religious ruling to attack the United States so that our Islam can solve our internal problems of who can become a caliphate and to reestablish the caliphate. So the issues related to leadership is the fact that how do we select a leader? Within the Sunnis, it's consensus. Within the Shia, it's blood relative. And then within the Qarajites, it's basically a sinless leader. But in reality, Islam has never followed the Sunni-Shia mentality. They followed what's called the strong man, the king of the hill. Basically, the guy with the biggest army took over everybody else, and he says, okay, what procedure do you want to apply upon me, because I'm in charge anyway? And they would all raise their hands and says, we're going to go for your system. And so as a result, the empires were started based upon a strong man mentality. So Osama bin Laden's goal was to end up creating the strong man, this idea that he can defeat both Russia and the United States, and he can be selected as the next religious leader of Islam. The thing to keep in mind is that is the goal of what's going on internally within Islam, is the selection of the next caliphate to reestablish Islam back into its rightful position by having a religious leader that they lost in 1924. Each of these groups are vying for that position. One of the reasons to go back to why was Iran trying to kill a Saudi Arabian ambassador was because there is a significant Iranian, Saudi, or Shia-Sunni battle as to who's going to take over the leadership, and they feel the leadership role is going to be filled quite soon. Which someone had mentioned something about Turkey the other day in a presentation. Turkey is the third one to vie for leadership within Islam. Turkey feels it's only within a couple of, maybe a year or so, before they can establish the caliphate through the current Turkish government. So you've got Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, you've got the Wahhabis in Saudi Arabia, you've got the Iranians with their 12th imam, and then, did I miss one here? Different groups are vying for position of who's going to run Islam, and who's going to become the caliphate. So the key is caliphate. The corruption, so the takeaway is the current radical movement is just an internal struggle over leadership and who's going to control Islam. The struggle relates to who's going to constitute leaders, how is a caliphate selected, and then what to do if in case a caliphate sins, called takfir. And then those who support a sinful leader are also to be considered takfir. That is why the attacks on the United States are ongoing. It's because the feeling is the United States is supporting or propping up illegitimate Islamic governments, like in Egypt or like Saudi Arabia or the list of Turkey, even Turkey. We give them money to prop up illegitimate leadership governments. As a result, the Muslims are mad at that government, and then as a result, mad at us. And so we are considered to be takfir, as considered to be, instead of kafir, which is unbelievers, we're considered to be takfir, which means apostate, really. And as a result, the Quran is quite clear. Anyone who's takfir should be eliminated. The planes that flew into the World Trade Center, and we wonder, how in the world can Muslims justify killing little babies inside of a nursery on the bottom floor? For what? You know, how can a religion do that? Well, the idea is that if we pay taxes to an illegitimate government, United States government, who ends up supporting illegitimate governments in Egypt, then we, by virtue of being Americans, are supporting illegitimate governments, and they are required by the Quran to kill people who support illegitimate governments. We find that a bit crazy, but that's the logic of the jihadis. Now, then again, moderates and secularists don't feel this way. It's just the upper echelon who have these types of attitudes. So the takeaway is the internal struggle. Now then, the next question can be, how pervasive is this mentality? So I had the privilege of conducting a international survey on how pervasive was the attitude of the caliphate. How many people really believe in this stuff? So I had two surveys, two questions, and a very, very expensive survey, international survey. It was a couple hundred thousand dollars, that type of thing. And my questions was related to, is a caliphate government superior to your government system? In other words, would you prefer to have a caliphate government over your current government system? I didn't deal with the word Sharia because that's a loaded question within Muslims, but caliphate they understand. So first one is your government system superior? And then the second one is, in your opinion, who would be a great candidate to become the next caliphate within Islam? It's a very simple survey question. We did it in three Islamic countries, Indonesia, Pakistan, and Egypt. And those of you who look at polling from government things, you'll see it's statistically valid to, say, plus or minus 3 points. This was the same way. This is statistically valid to plus or minus 3 points. So it was a valid survey field and a valid survey question. What came out was, that would your government be superior to a government system? Now, the little red thing doesn't work very well on here, but you'll see on an average about a third, about 38% of the fundamentalists felt a caliphate government would be superior to the government system. So we can actually say statistically, most Muslims feel, about a third of them, 38%, feel a caliphate system would be a superior government system than their current government system. Indonesia is a democratic country. Turkey is a democratic country. Egypt was kind of a dictatorship, but they're moving toward a democratic government. But still, they feel, if you look over here, Egypt on the far left side, 60% of them feel that they would rather have a caliphate system. And then you had the secularists, which is the yellow bar, is the next largest group, and is around 32%. And then the ones in between are the moderates. Now, any of you who know anything about elections, basically most elections in the U.S. is either the Republicans are going to vote Republican no matter what crackpot the Republicans have. The Democrats are going to vote Democrat no matter what kind of crackpot they've laid up for the Democrat. But it's the moderate in between. It's the regular guy who says, I'm neither one or the other. I'm just going to vote for whom I think is the best candidate. Moderates are always the ones who sway the election to one way or the other. So here we have the very same thing. About a third of Muslims, the fundamentalists, feel they'd like to have a caliphate system. A third of the secularists says, I don't want to have this thing. I want to live my life as a regular old kind of guy, and my kids go to college, and we have a good job. But it's the ones in between is what's considered to be the battleground for the hearts and minds of Muslims. So all the various activities, such as trying to kill a Saudi prince, it's the goal is to sway that meter one way or the other. So right now there's an internal struggle within Islam for the hearts and minds of the Muslim population. Then I asked the question, right, who would be, for those people who say they would rather have a caliphate government, just give me a name, any kind of name of a person that you feel would be a good potential candidate for a caliphate government. You know, Osama bin Laden or Ali Ahmed or who? Give me a name. Well, as it came out, only 3% of the Indonesia and 13% of the Pakistan could really actually offer me a name. And Egypt was not allowed to answer this question because you can probably guess Egypt was starting to feel the stress of the that ended up being the overthrow of the government. Only in Pakistan do we actually have one name that had more than 16 people who said. Now keep in mind, this is a large survey. Only 16 people could actually name, had an agreement on a name. But this guy, Nawaz Sharif, is Sharif actually means he's a descendant of Muhammad, so he's actually Shia, was a corrupt politician who was just, everything about him was bad. And the fact that they were actually saying that he could become a caliphate tells you that the depth of their understanding of that we really need a religious, a positive role model and a religious leader. The problem came into it, as this came out, was that if no one can't offer a consensus of a name, whether it's John Kerry, Mitt Romney, yeah, or Sarah Palin, or if anybody can't come up with a name of who they want for a presidential candidate, it's just, it feels like the whole candidacy is confusing. That's the way it is in the Islamic world. They can't name a single candidate. So then I go to, what does this mean? Roughly, basically a third of them want to replace their government with a government system, but they don't really have an idea on who that person is. But what we do know is that there is a feeling that I want my caliphate. I want to have a caliphate system, but I want my caliphate. I don't want your caliphate. And there lies the crucible of the struggle right now. My caliphate, but not your caliphate. So I go back to my buddies that I know really well, Ismail Yusanto of Hizb ut-Tahrir, and I said, what if Muslim Brotherhood's program works out like a charm, and they overthrow all the world government systems, and they establish a caliphate? Would you, Hizb ut-Tahrir, submit yourself, are we willing to follow the caliphate from Muslim Brotherhood? And Ismail Yusanto says, no way. We will reject Muslim Brotherhood because they didn't select it the right way. I said, okay. So then I run over and I talk to my guy, my buddy at Muslim Brotherhood, who is an upper-level leader, and I said to him, what if Hizb ut-Tahrir's plan works out like a charm? Then they have a real clear plan on overthrowing the governments and establishing a caliphate, and it's going to be their caliphate. Would you, Muslim Brotherhood, work underneath the caliphate system of Hizb ut-Tahrir? And Muslim Brotherhood says, they said, absolutely no way. We will not follow the Hizb ut-Tahrir caliphate system. So there led to the idea that there is this whole presentation that they want a caliphate system, but I don't want your caliphate, I want my caliphate. And as a result, we feel that there's massive destabilization that's going to occur in the caliphate and the choosing of the caliphate system. Now then, the Great Commission. That's my job. I'm in Job and Pioneers. What does this mean? Well, for one thing is, John 4:35, it basically says the harvest is plentiful, but the laborers are few. The fields are white for harvest. In Indonesia, when this same kind of thing happened in a smaller context in the 60s, when there was a whole kind of destabilization of the 60s, some of you probably remember that, there was millions of Muslims that were killed in a massive coup that occurred there. And at that particular time, Islam lost its grip over Indonesia, and within a few months, about 6 months, 2 million Muslims came to faith in a very short period of time. And only one mission organization, that was a Southern Baptist, had looked ahead on this and says, we're going to prepare ourselves for a lot of Muslims coming to faith at one time. And sure enough, if you look at the growth of the Baptist in Indonesia, it goes along a very small trajectory. All of a sudden, it shoots up very straight as they were able to process and receive 2 million Muslims coming to faith very, very quickly. Now then, here you are in Pennsylvania, and here we are, a small church of about 400. What if all of a sudden you had a couple of million Muslims coming to faith? How would this, or even a couple of million, Pennsylvanians coming to faith, is this church equipped to handle millions or 10,000 or 1,000 people coming to faith and coming to church right now. I know the elder board or your deacon board is already starting to sweat, thinking, how in the world are we going to follow up on this amount of people very fast who all come to faith and they don't really have any background? You've got homosexuals and you've got, you know, people living together and you've got all kinds of weird problems going out there. How can we end up following up and discipling large numbers of people? That is Pioneer's problem, is that we see lots of Muslims coming to faith in a very short period of time, and we have to figure out systems by which we're able to follow up large numbers of Muslims who are going to come to faith when one of these groups chooses a caliphate system. So we have an issue. We need more laborers. We need more field workers. And Luke 10:2 is a very interesting passage if you've ever looked at it. This is the one where Jesus is sending out 72 after he sent out the 12, and they've gone out and shared the gospel and come back, and they're quite excited that they're able to raise the dead and heal the sick and things like this. And then Jesus does some more ministry, and there are 72 people coming around Jesus. And then he sends out the 72 into the field, and he says to him, "The harvest is plentiful, but the laborers are few. Therefore, beseech the Lord the harvest, beseech the Lord of harvest to send out more laborers into the harvest." Now then, the disciples understood that passage a little differently than most of us understand it. Missions conferences are typically about trying to recruit people from within their congregation to go to strange places, eat strange things, and share the gospel with people who don't really like you. And that really is not a very appealing message to most people in churches. But the disciples understood this a little differently. Instead of saying, go out and try to recruit more people to go in and join you because we need more people, the idea is that this is the biggest group that they've recruited so far. Jesus was saying to them, within the harvest are going to become the harvesters. And so he says, pray for, as you go out and meet these men of peace, person of peace, that they are going to become the harvesters within the harvest. And so there are other passages in here that deals with the man of peace, identifying the man of peace, and how to equip this man of peace to become a harvester within the harvest. So some of the goal of what we're looking at is not so much we're always recruiting for more people. We're thinking very strategically about how can we, within the harvest, train people to become harvesters. How can we identify people who are Muslims who come to faith and quickly make them into missionaries within the Islamic world? Remember Don talking last night as he worked with the Sawi. The first Sawi man says, "Hey, can I come with you, Don, and we'll go and preach to all these other people?" Well, that's actually what happened. The Sawis began to reach other Sawis, so within the harvest became the harvesters. So the strategy of mission organizations like Pioneers or others is, how can we quickly take, when you got 2 million people coming to faith, how can we quickly help train leaders and help them grow spiritually as disciples, but yet be harvesters within the harvest? That is the kind of thing that we're thinking about right now. How can you create harvesters out of the harvest? It's going to come by more prayer, more churches like this church getting behind praying for organizations like Pioneers or Wycliffe or World Team, and also getting behind, almost in some sense, supporting of nationals who are in the fields, who are actually the closest to identifying harvesters and harvesting. The other thing is a more willingness of people within this congregation, other congregations, to go. But one of the biggest problems that keeps mission people who are thinking about missions from going into the mission field is parents. Parents are not really excited about sending their kid off to Penn State or to some college and giving them a great education to become a doctor or a lawyer, or getting out of the conditions that we grew up with. And I have 4 children. I know the struggle. And yet, then having them say, "Guess what, Dad? I went to a missions conference, and I'm all jazzed about going to Yemen and reaching Muslims who probably don't like me, and I have to eat strange things and live in strange places and to reach a bunch of people who don't like me." Parents could say, "Well, you know, actually there's great ministries around here. Maybe you should be involved in Philadelphia. They've got a lot of whacked out people there. Why don't you go reach the whacked out people in Philadelphia? Don't go to Yemen." And so parents typically try to dissuade children to say, "Yeah, do ministry, but don't do it over there where the bad people live. Do it right here." And so parents get to be in some sense, a drag on kids wanting to go out. In some sense, parents need to be thinking about these, saying, I am like Samuel. I am like the father or mother of the Samuel who's willing to offer up my child to do the thing that God has called him to do. Because we're involved in eternity. Is there a God? Does God have a plan? It's far better that my children be involved in God's plan than be in my plan. And I, as a parent, know that half my plans are totally whacked out for my kids. I tried to set my daughter up several times to real losers. And she was wise enough to blow off her dad and meet a pretty decent guy. So parents aren't really the best people to, in some sense, give children advice on their future. But God is significantly better. So I would say encourage parents, think about the bigger picture of being involved in God's plan for your child's life. And encourage them to do what God is moving them to do and help empower that. Okay, what are some of the spiritual lessons for us at Church of the Living Christ? First of all, is don't miss out on the big story of what God is doing to reach the sons of Ishmael or the Muslims of the world by concerning ourselves with little stories such as radicalism, jihadism, the housing crisis, who's going to become the next president, she would be in Afghanistan. All these sorts of things are small story things as compared to the big story of what God is doing in the rest of the world, and that God is wanting to bring the sons of Ishmael into a relationship with Him. So, focus on the right things as we talk about among ourselves, keeping the main thing, and don't get involved in the short-term thing. Is it going to be Mitt Romney or is it going to be Obama? Honestly, I don't really care because I happen to believe that God is still in charge no matter which one of these guys, which I'm not excited about either one of them, are in charge of America. But I'm not even really excited about America anymore because I'm starting to see God doing some tremendous things over there. And he is doing something today I wouldn't believe even if I was told. That's that Habakkuk 1:5 passage. The second thing is, what is it that they want? What is it that Muslims really, really want? They are looking for a king. They're looking for a leader who is sinless, who can lead them into a right relationship. And so I probably would ask you the question, who would be the rightly guided caliphate? And I think I just pushed the wrong button and wiped the whole thing out. But God, Muslims are looking for a leader, someone to lead them. And so when Muslims come to faith, that is the first thing that they are so excited about, is that they have a clear Lord of their life. Muslims are so much easier to lead them into lordship than Americans are. In fact, most of them make Christ the Lord of their life before they understand anything about the tenets of salvation. I'll give you one example, and then I think we're going to take a little bit of a coffee break, and I can maybe take a couple questions on this part of the presentation as I move into the next one. When I was in Indonesia, I had a guy there. His name was Rahmat. Rahmat had... I'm staying with Ben, and Ben was telling me some of his Gideon stories. Rahmat is a Muslim who happened to have one day, he was as a young man, a crazy man with hair sticking out and no clothes on at all, came to him and handed him a Bible and said, "Read this." Now, if I was 14 years old and a naked crazy man with bushy hair handed me a Bible and told me to read it, I would probably pay attention to the book or be scared and run. So Rahmat takes this Bible as a Muslim and hides it underneath his bed. And he then pulls it out on an ongoing basis and he reads the scriptures. And he then, through a period of time, decides he wants to become a follower of Christ. And I met Rahmat soon after that. And he began to share Christ. Now, keep in mind, this guy is only a young believer out of a Muslim background who got a Bible from a crazy man. And he is wanting to grow in his faith. Suddenly, his family finds out that he has now made a decision to make Christ become a follower of Christ. And they're going to call him into a meeting called a mushwa. And this is a time when the family leaders want to determine whether or not he is murtad. And according to the Quran, if he's become a believer as a Muslim, then he should be executed. So I worked with Rahmat for about 2 weeks before he goes in this meeting, and he and I spent time studying the Quran and the scriptures so that when they do this interview, that he could actually answer correctly. If he answered poorly, then there was one of the cousins who was designated to slit his throat. So that's really kind of an intensive discipleship program, I'll tell you. Well, Rachmat and I am sitting there going, I hope I get this thing right because this guy, I may not see him. Then Rachmat and I met for a couple of weeks, and then I prayed with him, and he goes off into his meeting to die, possibly die for his faith. He understood lordship as a believer of less than probably 6 months, and he was willing to die for his faith with just a little bit of an understanding of the Scriptures, but with a deep faith and with full of the Holy Spirit that Christ was Lord of his life. I sit down and think about this on time-to-time basis, how easily we as Christians blow off the lordship of Christ only to really stick with the whole salvation part. You know, basically, God has saved me, but don't mess with my life. I am Lord of my own life. Christ is Lord of my soul when I die. No, Rachmat understood that Christ is Lord of my life now, and I'm willing to die for my faith as a follower of Jesus. Those are deep privileges that I've had in working with Muslims, that they understand lordship significantly easier than most of us of Americans. So the idea that Christ is in charge, God is in charge, He has a plan. Only thing that we have to do is really understand God has a plan, and I'm going to get on board with it. All this radicalism, all jihadism, is all a part of God's plan of introducing Christ, or having Christ be introduced to large numbers of Muslims in the Islamic world. I think there's going to be some coffee or something somewhere. Or I hope it's not that Tylenol. That's not it back there. No, that's baby bottles and Tylenol. But somewhere there's going to be some coffee and cookies and stuff. But as I set it up, let me take a couple of questions from you guys, because I like, again, this is the part I like most of all. I probably stirred up a few little ideas in your head. What is a question that you have on some things? Yes. Rachmat, that's a really fun story. Rachmat then goes into this meeting, and he sits in a chair in the middle of about eight of his uncles and all of his cousins sitting in the second room. And they peppered him with questions for 8 hours, trying to see if they could find some way to determine whether or not he's become apostate within Islam. After the end of the day, they couldn't determine that he is actually he has left Allah and has started following this foreign god. They actually came out with saying this guy is actually showing more holiness than any of us have, but they still weren't sure. So they said, "Okay, family, it's got to go home. It's 5 o'clock. My wife is mad at me. All these types of things. So we'll come back next month and have the same meeting." So Uncle A set up the first meeting. Then they determined Uncle B was going to be to set up the second meeting. So the next month, Rachmat was going to be called again. So he and I get together and we prayed and we did some more studying of the Quran and the Scriptures and prayed for him. He comes back the second month and had another 8-hour meeting to determine whether or not he's murtad. They couldn't make any determination of whether or not he was murtad out of that meeting. Then they were going to set up the meeting, the third meeting. And one of the uncles set up the meeting, get the chairs and the location and everything, and they had a third meeting. Then when they got ready, they couldn't determine it there. They're going to set up a fourth meeting. And then in that one, they couldn't find an uncle to manage everything. So Rachmat says, "I'll organize the fourth meeting." And so they said, a little weird, but okay. So Rachmat did. He got the chairs. And then they set him down in the middle of the floor, of the room. And he says, "Since I'm in charge of it, let me sing you a song of worship. A beautiful Sunanese song of worship to Allah." And it was about how Isa is his. I get my Indonesian suddenly. I go in Indonesian here. So hold on a second. He is his go-between God and man. The man Christ Jesus leads. He is our advocate to the Father. Beautiful song. And so everybody was really touched at this song. Then they go in and interview him for 8 hours, and couldn't determine at that point. And at that point, all the uncles says, "Look, if we can't figure this thing out after four meetings, this is wasting our time. And look, you uncle who first brought these charges against me, who is the imam or the head of a mosque, you're bringing charges against this guy, and he is by far more holy than you are. You've cheated on your image. You beat your wife. You speak ill of all kinds of people. You're always angry. This guy is full of the spirit of Allah. So I have much rather be what he is than what you are." And so we're not having these things anymore. They're aggravating. They're taking up my Saturdays. So we're not having these meetings anymore. Soon after the meeting, two of his cousins, who are the sons of the imam, came to Rahmat and says, I don't know what you have, but I want to have what you have. So Rahmat led two of his cousins to Christ, and it was a privilege to work with this guy for many, many years in ministry. So he stood the test of time and went through the persecution and was willing to die for his faith, and God has used him mightily in the lives of other people in leading other Muslims to faith and walking with God. So I tell you what, I have felt like my time working with Muslims is like I'm sitting on the 50-yard line of the Super Bowl, and it is some exciting stuff that happens. I wouldn't give up anything in lieu of the relationship that I've had, of the privilege of serving among Muslims for these good many years. But anyway, who else has a question? Yeah.
You mentioned that you were friends with two of the different extremists.
Uh-huh.
Well,
because I was a researcher with a university, and they wanted to influence policy in the United States, so they felt that they influenced a guy who was in charge of major research projects within the government, that they could actually make influence over policies. Now, they knew that I was a follower of Jesus, and I was a serious follower of Jesus, but I was a professional, I was a researcher, so they carried me in. In fact, Ishmael and I used to sit down for hours and have great conversations. And he tells me, anytime you want to come, when you come back to Indonesia, let me know. This guy's busy. He's really busy. He flies all over the place and does seminars. Again, he was in charge of this seminar of 90,000 radicals and jihadis. But he likes to spend time with me. And I think it's the Spirit of God really using me in a very special way. Sometimes he brings his two wives. It's kind of a weird setting. And I sometimes going, this is totally weird. I'm a redneck from North Carolina, a tobacco farmer, somehow staggered in the middle of this thing, and I'm meeting with this radical leader. So it's kind of funny how God just worked this whole thing out. Yes. That's a good question. Linda stays pretty busy herself at the home office, but she tries to go with me about one out of four times. She's not real jazzed about going and meeting with radical leaders for some odd reason. It's okay. She says, okay, I'll pray for you. And some of these flights are long and hard and stuff like that. But it is a strain on us. Last year was a total killer for us. She was having some health issues, and I was having to make really hard decisions to go and be involved in training of people to reach Muslims and then to be away from home. So, you know, it's part of what we do. And this next year is probably going to be the same way. Again, I just came back from Togo and Burkina Faso. In about 2 weeks, I'm going to UK and Istanbul. So this travel thing gets to be an aggravation. I mean, I was taking some medicine for my back because it's killing my back flying these long flights. But yeah. We try to do what we can to manage and balance everything as much as possible. Yes?
You mentioned Togo. Is that Togo, Africa?
That's correct, uh-huh.
Do you know Becky in there?
No.
Mm-mm. Okay.
Yeah, I don't know Becky. I'm not sure. I work mostly with Africans. Now, let me tell you about this Togo thing. This is really kind of fun. This is Africans. We're training to reach Africa. It's called, we're developing what we call the fire, the wall of fire. It's basically Togo and above is north, is basically Islamically controlled area. And Togo south, or basically Ghana south, is Christian controlled area. But the Muslims are coming south to try to convert and change Islam. So they're coming, making incursions into the south. And of course, north is moves gradually more radical and fundamentalist. We draw this line of fire right here, and we're working on training Christian background peoples in the south to reach Muslims down there. So we're next year, I was just there setting this up, we're going to train 1,000 church planters and church members how to reach Muslims in the south part. Then we're also working with the basically Muslim background believers and Africans to 1,000 of them also, 500 of them to go north and 500 to go south. That's what it is, the way it works out. And now these are just Africans training Africans to reach Africans. So it's a totally African thing. So if Becky is a Caucasian, which is probably is, and I won't be able to be part of this thing, we want to make it fully African That's African-owned African type of thing. At the same time, we're doing in Philippines and doing the same thing. We're going to Manila, training Filipinos to reach Muslims. But what this, instead of reaching just Muslims in Philippines, which is in South Philippines, there are more Filipinos in the Middle East than there are any other national group. They're involved in doctors or hospitals and things like this. And we're wanting to, in some sense, empower the Filipinos to reach Muslims in the Middle East. So in one sense, Africa, we're looking at this way. And with Philippines, we're kind of like going this way. It's trying to empower Filipinos to reach the Middle East. And if we feel that this is a two-pronged strategy of moving the nationals, then we can have a chance to make a strong incursion into the Islamic world. So it's a fun and a heavy responsibility that we're trying to cover. So, yeah. Yes. Uh-huh. Okay, your question is, I forgot I'm supposed to repeat these questions because it's going to be in tapes. Is your question is, how strong is a Muslim as a force of the Muslims, how big of a strong of an influence is Muslim Brotherhood in the Arab Spring? What's your other part? So the second question is, Muslim Brotherhood, which are they, radical, fundamentalist, moderate, that type of thing? First question is, it is by far the strongest Islamic force within the world. Muslim Brotherhood in the U.S. owns about 80% of the mosque. They have about 172 front organizations here in the U.S., and that's just the U.S. And we'll talk about in a little bit about Organization of Islamic Council, which is underneath the United Nations. They're very much involved in that one. And then, of course, Egypt and Muslim Brotherhood. In Indonesia, it's Partai Keadilan Sejahtera. There's a good chance they could take over the presidency in the next elections. In Africa, they're strong. So they are a formidable force in the influence of the Islamic world. Are they moderate? Are they fundamentalists? They're by far probably more fundamentalists, but they have a lot of secularist elements, and they have some jihadi elements. Hamas is part of Muslim Brotherhood. And so they run a gamut. They have a lot of kind of tools they can pull from their toolkit. They are the next group that's going to be influential in what we feel is in the Islamic movement. Now then, with that in mind, if Muslim Brotherhood takes over and they actually establish a caliphate, the Shias are left out, the Sufis are left out, what's this other group called? Anyway, no, there's a whole alphabet soup of groups that are going to be left out of the movement of what's going on. And we feel those are going to be ones who are open for conversion as we've never seen before. So they are a formidable force. Pay attention to that in the news. What happened right now with the military delaying the elections in Egypt is probably orchestrated by Muslim Brotherhood in the background. So, yeah, very large group, very powerful, fundamentalist in nature. They're Sunni, and they're going to be our next the next issue group. Any other questions? Yeah. It is accurate. I've talked to Hizb ut-Tahrir. Okay, the question is, the Arab Spring, they say that it's a movement toward democracy, that they're really it's a good thing for democracy. Is it really a democratic movement? And I say, and my answer to that, yes, it is. But the problem is democracy is a loosely used term. We think of democracy as American democracy. There are other kinds of democracy. Their idea of democracy is that all people live free underneath the caliphate. So do we say that's our kind of democracy? I think Kissinger says, well, we don't always believe in other people's democracy, but we do believe in our kind of democracy. So it is a democracy where they choose a caliphate and they live under the caliphate who wants to expand Islam throughout the whole world. So it is the goal of the caliphate and Muslim Brotherhood is to see Islam in control of all systems, world systems throughout the world. It is a political. It's a political agenda of world domination to function well underneath their interpretation of what democracy is. So as a result, I don't think many of you would say, I feel pretty excited about being underneath the caliphate. I'd rather give Obama back, you know. it is a different kind of system. And you a little bit have to understand Islam is both political and religious at the same time, whereas Christianity and other religions are not. They're religious, and then you have political systems. Islam is political. Good darn. Sure. Good, that's an excellent question. So he wanted to ask the question about the word Allah. Is it, what's the term come from? And then how we deal with the deity of Christ as I deal with sharing the gospel with Muslims. If you remember in the scriptures, you've got most of the Old Testament is written in Hebrew. Most of the New Testament is written in Greek. The only book that's written in a different language is the book of Daniel, and that's written in Aramaic. And then when Eshak, Meshach, and Abednego is being tossed into the furnace, and they walk around there, and four people are walking around. The king of Babylon stands up and he looks inside and he calls out to Eshak, Meshach, and Abednego, come out, because I believe that your God is the Most High God. The word that's used in there, your God is the Most High God, is we believe that your Allah is the Most High Allah. So Allah is just a term that's used by the Arabic or Aramaic speaking people as the Most High God. Now then, those of you who are Bible scholars know that there is in the Old Testament they use Elohim. In the New Testament, they use in our English translation, we have God. But in the Greek, it uses the word theos, right? So theos, none of you refer to, I am going to the church of theos. You know, we use the church of God. Where do we get the word God from? The word God comes from, it's actually Germanic in its origins. And it happened to be when the missionaries go up to Germany to share the gospel with the Germans, they asked them, okay, within your worldview, who is the most supreme religious person that you have? Now, they were polytheists, and they said, well, we got the rock thing, and we got the tree thing, and we got all these little spiritual things, but the one who lives in the top of the highest pine is the Most High God. And the missionaries, and they basically were good. He is the Most High Good. And we get the word English, G-O-D. This is good. It just comes from the whole idea that it relates to religion, to German. So we end up translating this from German to English, and we have the word God. And the feeling is that God is the right word for talking about our most supreme religious leader. But we don't really use Elohim very much, and particularly we feel weirded out by the word Allah, because Allah is like this Muslim thing, but we follow the right way, which is the God thing. Well, we probably should be using theos as the better word instead of God or Allah or Elohim, because we're New Testament people, right? But we don't. We use God, which is a Germanic word. It's just a translation of a concept of the Most High spiritual being. Now then, his second question is, how do I deal with the deity of Christ? Well, the deity of Christ in the way that we share the gospel is a very important concept where we want people to understand that Jesus is God. And when you understand Jesus is God, then you can understand the sacrifice of sin. So we have kind of like pre-salvation things you got to understand. Then we have sanctification activities that occurs after that. When I try to force Muslims to understand the deity of Christ in salvation, they get very confused because of some Quranic passages. When I don't really deal with Christ being deity, but I deal with Christ as being my mediator between God and man, the man Christ Jesus, I find a lot of levels of receptivity. A little bit what Don was talking about from dealing with the Sawi with one particular way. The deity of Christ, with most Muslims who have actually made a lordship decision for faith, becomes an easy concept for them to grab. When I try to do it on the front end side, on the salvation side, they don't get it. They don't really. There's conception they can't get it, but they do understand Christ as being the mediator between God and man in Christ Jesus. They get that real easily. Christ being God is difficult for them to mentally get their head around because of some terms like shirk. So, I don't really try to deal with the deity side, but I can take them to Al Imran, and I really work with that from the Quran to talk about that Jesus is both the creator, he is the word of Allah, and he is his disciples are filled with the spirit of Allah. So those concepts they can grasp, if they can grasp anything, but what they're really looking for is a mediator between man and God, man Christ Jesus. How Jesus gets to be the mediator is really, doesn't become an issue with them. What qualifies him to become the mediator? They just know he is a mediator. So they make lordship decisions and make a decision for make Christ their mediator. After salvation, what we call salvation, they're able to get their head around the concept of the Trinity, of the Spirit of God, and Jesus is God. So to answer your question, I work with it in the sanctification process. You know, it's after salvation they get the theology straight there. But to get the theology straight before conversion is only confusing to them. I don't think the disciples really understood that Jesus was God until way late into the process. And I'd be willing to bet most of you, before you became a believer, if you really just sit down and play the tape back and watch the video of you coming to faith, you are totally confused about the whole fact that Jesus was God. But as you become strengthened by the work of the Holy Spirit in your life, this issue becomes much clearer to you. So I don't try to force something that's not really there on the early side. So I don't deny it. They ask me, do I believe that Jesus is God? I say to them, I believe what the Quran says about Jesus. And they're going, okay. But what the Quran does say, that Jesus is the creator, he is the word of Allah, and he is the spirit of Allah. And that's very clear. So I don't try to deal with the issue a whole lot. It works, but so. It's Al Imran, which is number 3, verses 45 through around 55. And I could probably pull it out and read it to you in a couple of minutes. But it just says that Jesus, and I'm not going to say to you it's the Word of God. I don't treat the Quran as if the Word of God, and I don't give it honor. But if you meet someone who's actually a faithful reader of Reader's Digest, and you can take them and say, well, there's a great thing in Reader's Digest about something or other, I just treat it as if it's a document that is revered to them, just like Don was talking about the Athenians reading their prophetic religious literature about their gods, Theo, and things like this. So Al Imran is a good one to talk about that. I can walk you through it at some point. It gets a little complicated, but Muslims converts have one who led me to that. So when you really read the Arabic in depth, that's where it really understands. So I think they've got some stuff over here. Any other questions? Probably the next section we'll have more time for questions after I'll do my next one, which is what's going on in the current Christian movement. All right, I think we're supposed to take a break, and I'll come back and we'll do some more discussion on some research that we've done. So, thank you. I think drinks, is that right? Drinks and everything's over here.